Well, it's great to be with you this weekend, and great to be asked to speak on the Dutch Reformation. This is the first time in my life I've done a conference on this subject, and I'm delighted to bring you the basics. Tonight we're going to look at really the basics of the Reformation, give you more of the facts and how it developed and so on. Tomorrow morning, we'll focus more specifically on what impact did John Calvin have on Dutch Calvinism. And then I want to focus with you on the second major Dutch Reformation called the Nadere Reformatie, sometimes translated the Dutch Further Reformation, in the closing address as we look at how God continued to work among the Dutch people and beyond them, also in the Dutch-speaking lands until this very day. And there are still many, many people in the Netherlands, and now happily also in America, that are beginning to read or continuing to read these great Dutch writers. I want you to turn with me to Psalm 78, and give you a biblical justification for what we're doing this weekend, as John Payne already hinted at. Psalm 78, 1 through 8. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. I don't know if you caught this, but do you see the tremendous emphasis here on children? We are so glad tonight to see some children here, because really the purpose of declaring history is not just to feed ourselves with nostalgic reminiscing, but it's to teach our children the works that God has done, says the psalmist, so that they would pass it on to their children, and their children would pass it on to children who are not yet born. So I like to think of what we're doing tonight and tomorrow morning is we're passing on the wonderful works of God that he's done in the Reformation in the Netherlands to children who aren't even born yet. That's the goal. Because his works are great and mighty, and they are worthy to be extolled from generation to generation. Now, if we forget those works, as Reverend Payne implied in his introductory remarks, what's going to happen is that a generation will arise who set not their hearts aright and who are not steadfast with God. So, church history, both in its errors and in its strengths, both in its backslidings and in the wonderful works of God in that history, serve as beacons of encouragement and beacons of warning to us how to walk ourselves. And so they buttress what we learn in Scripture, and they help us to turn to the living God for strength to do so. Now, to cover the Dutch Reformation, from the mid-1540s, when it entered the Dutch territories, to 1619, which is the conclusion of the Great National Synod of Dort that solidified in a confessional way the completion of the third form of unity, that is, the third doctrinal standard. So they were all in place, what the Dutch reformers believed. To do that in one evening is a rather formidable task. But we're going to try to do it by focusing on the highlights. And so I've given you outlines this weekend, which is not what I normally do, but I want to stick fairly closely to the outlines so that if some of you know next to nothing about the Dutch Reformation, the steep learning curve you'll have this weekend won't overwhelm you, because you'll be able to reference the outline and take just a few notes, perhaps, and hopefully learn a great deal and be encouraged in your faith. Well, the Reformation in the Netherlands is full of complexities, more than nearly any other nation. And part of that is because of its unique geography and its very distinctive history. The geography and history of what we call, or what was called rather, the Low Countries, L-O-W, the Low Countries. So named because the actual geography of the country was such that a good part of the land was below or just at sea level. They were very low countries physically. And hence we get the word nether lands. Nether meaning low lands. Think in the Bible of the nether and the upper millstone, the upper and the nether, lower millstone. So Netherlands simply means lowlands, low countries. So what we want to do is first we'll look tonight, just a brief introductory word about the geography of the Low Countries or the Netherlands, for which I've given you this insert sheet that you can study at home. And then I want to address three things. First, the reform that came to the Netherlands before Calvin's influenced the Netherlands, that is before the 1540s, what was going on. Secondly, we want to look at the political history of the Netherlands, because that's inextricably interwoven with the Reformation itself. And you've got to just completely get rid of tonight the idea of separation of church and state, because this does not work with the Netherlands or anywhere in Europe in the 16th century, but the Netherlands in particular. And then thirdly, we want to spend a good half of our time looking at the actual history of the Reformation going from 1545 to 1619. So first, just a short introductory word about the geography. And I've subtitled this, Unity and Autonomy. Now, when we talk about the Netherlands in the 16th century, we actually mean an area quite a bit larger than we speak of the Netherlands today. It includes today's Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and a little bit of northwestern France. So it's an area of some size and actually was quite important. It was an area of commerce and trade and textile production, and therefore had a great deal of wealth. The ports of Antwerp and Amsterdam were significant trading ports already then. So the Netherlands was important to Europe as a whole because it was a significant economic center of activity. Now, this whole area consisted of 17 provinces. And these provinces had some common history. That is, they had some sense of belonging to one another. There was some sense of unity. But they also had a great sense of independency. Sort of like, think of the American colonies before the Revolutionary War. They had a sense of their own local history, but also their own political independence. And even though Charles V was their sovereign, he did not rule over the Netherlands as the Holy Roman Emperor. Nor did he rule over them as the King of Spain. But actually, he ruled over province by province. He was the Count of the province of Zeeland. He was the Duke of the province of Gelderland, and so on. In other words, he was installed in these provinces as the local sovereign, showing the autonomy of each of these provinces. Now, the Netherlands was not even united linguistically. In the north, it was basically a form of Dutch that was spoken. In the south, it was mostly French. And if you follow the history today of Belgium, you'll know that the conflict between Dutch-speaking Belgium and French-speaking Belgium is still a tension in the country of Belgium today. Now, the main focus politically beyond Charles that brought all these provinces together was that there was a thing called States General. Spelled just like state with an S on it, no possessive. States General. It consisted of seven men, sort of a small parliament, you might say. And these seven men took up the interests of the 17 provinces and debated various circumstances and cases, and collectively strove to come to unanimous votes on various things that benefited the 17 provinces. A majority vote was not good enough. If they didn't get 7-0, whatever they decided was not implemented. And that state's general body served then as an advisory panel to the monarch. And in this way, there was some tie between the provinces. Well, so much for introduction. And let's move now to what was going on before Calvinism came to the Netherlands in the 1540s. Well, like most European countries, there was a variety of cultural and intellectual and religious forces at work that helped pave the way for the Reformation to come. And unfortunately, we don't have time to go into all the cultural and intellectual forces that were at work, though that would be interesting. But I want to just set before you four religious influences. First of all, there was the Brethren of the Common Life. You notice on the outline, 1350 to 1520. So this is a fairly lengthy movement. What happened is that around the middle of the 14th century, there was a growing concern for religious reform in the Roman Catholic Church in the Netherlands. And early expressions of that need surrounded a man named Jan van Rijsbroek, who yearned for a more intimate, godly relationship with God. Maybe even a bit of a mystical relationship with God. But he was weary of the abuses of the Roman Catholic Church. And he developed a following around him. His most famous disciple was a guy by the name of Gerard Grote, Groote, 1340 to 1384. And he established this fellowship that he called the Brethren of the Common Life. And the Brethren of the Common Life focused on a practical Christian living in devotion to the Lord Jesus. They based their belief system on some monastic principles, but they didn't bind anyone to an oath of fellowship or to become a monk or anything of that sort. And what they did do that was long-lasting is they were very dedicated to study. They copied lots of manuscripts, religious manuscripts. They established schools in different places throughout the provinces, and they promoted this warm, intimate relationship with God. And this spiritual environment, fostered by the Brethren, gave birth to its greatest devotional work, one that you've all heard of, I'm sure, Thomas a Kempis, The Imitation of Christ. Outside of John Bunyan's Holy War, and perhaps the Heidelberg Catechism, and the Bible, of course, no book has sold so much in human history as Kempis's Imitation of Christ. And typical of the Brethren of the Common Life, This work was a stress on the spiritual internal relationship between the soul and Christ. And it stressed the importance, too, of a moral life. And that was typical of this early pre-Reformation movement against, or rather, of concern about the Roman Catholic Church. But it was the work of another man who followed Kempis and who was influenced by the Brethren of the Common Life that really paved the way for the receptivity of the Reformation in the Netherlands. And this man deserves to be much better known than he is. His name was Wessel Gansfort, Gansfort. Wessel Gansfort, 1419 to 1489. He brought into the movement a real concern for sound doctrine in addition to godly living. And he seemed to have a very spiritual view of the Lord's Supper. He rejected transubstantiation. And Martin Luther looked to him later and said that he was one of the few forerunners of the Reformation who actually was teaching something akin to justification by faith alone. Now today, there's a great need for a few very good scholars to really study this man a great deal more. So it was on the eve of the Reformation that this Brethren of the Common Life movement that culminated in Gansfort and also helped educate, by the way, the great humanist scholar Erasmus, that the way was paved for a receptivity of the Reformation in the Low Countries. Now, when the Reformation came in 1517 in Germany, it took only 3 years to really make inroads into the Netherlands. And it came first, of course, in the form of Lutheranism. In fact, by 1523, two Lutheran martyrs were put to death in the Netherlands. And the message of Luther had already made great grounds by that time. And yet Lutheranism never spread throughout the Netherlands. There was never a dominant Lutheranism. It was just a remnant movement, never widespread. And it was followed by a movement, as you notice on the outline, I call it, for lack of a better name, Sacramentarianism. The Sacramentarians also were not a widespread popular movement, but it was a limited remnant, and yet an important remnant, a kind of intellectual elite throughout the Netherlands that focused their attention particularly on the Lord's Supper. And the leader among them was a man named Cornelius Hoen, H-O-E-N. And he wrote a very influential letter that was passed around and influenced a lot of people in the Netherlands, a letter that stressed the symbolic character of the Lord's Supper. It was sort of like Zwingli's view on the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper was a memorial, yet there was more stress on the Lord's Supper, on having the Lord's Supper, and the spirituality of that memorial. Well, then in the 1530s, the Anabaptists gained ground in the Netherlands. In fact, the Netherlands was really one of the major strongholds of the Anabaptist movement. And that was true both of the radical Anabaptists like Huffman and the uprising at Munster under the leadership of Jan Bukelzon, but it was also true of the pacifist Anabaptists who were against war, never took up the sword, and were very peaceful. Men like Menno Simons and David Joris. Now, this was the first time that a kind of Reformation movement in the Netherlands really took off and really penetrated the populace in large numbers. Lutheranism never really did that, nor did Sacramentarianism. But the Anabaptist movement had such a significant following in the Netherlands that people became alarmed about it. And because of its ideas that you couldn't swear an oath before a judge, and you couldn't take up a sword to defend in war. And it's sometimes influencing people to withdraw themselves from society. It seemed to the monarch and to people that were in political power to be a threat to the whole fabric of society. And so the Anabaptists were very much persecuted. Many of them were killed in the Netherlands. And that deeply impacted the Dutch people. So that even today, there's kind of a, in many Dutch people, a kind of a sense of toleration of disparate groups because of the fear of persecution, kind of antipathy toward religious persecution. Well, these then are some of the early Reformation movements that helped ripen the time of the coming of Calvinism to the Netherlands. Now, it is impossible to explain what Calvinism is in the Netherlands without considering the political developments in that time. So we turn to that now in our second major head of our 3 points this evening. Charles V was a very popular sovereign in the Netherlands. He spent time living there. He knew the people. The people loved him. He had a measure of respect for their ancient liberties. But he was a Roman Catholic. And even when Protestantism began to spread in the Netherlands, and Charles took strong measures against it and actually began to use measures of persecution, he still remained popular. Now, that may have been in part because the earliest spread of Reformed influences was through the movement of Anabaptism, and people were suspicious of the impact of this dangerous and possibly anarchistic movement. But Charles really never lost his popularity, even when he started persecuting the people who were embracing Protestant truth. In 1555, Charles V abdicated as the sovereign of the Netherlands, and his authority passed on to his son, Philip II of Spain. Now, this is very important to understand, because Philip was not well acquainted with the Netherlands, didn't know what made the Dutch people tick, hadn't spent time there, didn't speak any of the local languages, he only spoke Spanish, and he was perceived by the people as a foreign oppressor, a kind of foreign tyrant. Now, the Dutch were, and in some ways still are, fiercely independent. Hence, there wasn't just this unity I talked about, but remember, the autonomy. And Philip's goal, when he took over, was to make all these provinces centralized in political power. In other words, to establish a centralized government that ruled everything. He wanted to streamline the government and to take away power from individual provinces and put it in the hands of the government. Well, there's nothing new under the sun. Now, people didn't like that, just like people are rising up against it today. They wanted to see this unique arrangement of individual provinces with different languages retain a great deal of independence. But Philip wanted to establish centralized government. He wanted to establish more bishoprics of the church and have different areas under various bishoprics. He wanted more organization. And he wanted to take advantage of the economic wealth of the Netherlands for the royal coffers of Roman Catholicism and for political coffers. And so he increased the taxes of the people. Again, nothing new under the sun. And again, the people didn't respond well. If you know Dutch people, they don't respond well to increased taxation. So Philip succeeded in alienating many people. Not only the common people, they were impacted by his changes in the church primarily, but also the nobility who didn't like his system of bishoprics because the nobility was used to the idea that the younger sons would become bishops and not the kind of top-down structure that Philip wanted to initiate. And so it spread throughout all the Netherlands that Philip was insensitive to the traditional liberties and the prerogatives of the Netherlands people. Now that came to a head in 1566. In a short movement, only lasted a year or so, called the Iconoclastic Movement. And what that means is that mobs throughout the country organized and began to break into churches and throw down statues. And some places, they even beat up the priests. It was a venting of the rage and the antagonism towards Philip that the Dutch people were feeling. So how does Philip respond? Again, a very common response by a monarch who wants total governmental control. He responds with an iron hand. He sends a man called the Duke of Alva. The Dutch people renamed him the Iron Duke, who was supposed to maintain peace through his Spanish troops. But the people resented the Spanish troops, and a revolt took place. The leading figure you need to remember in the revolt is a man named William of Orange. And he was at the head of what came to be known as the famous 80 Years' War, a war of Dutch resistance against Spain that dragged on for decades and ultimately led to the independence of the Netherlands from Spain. Now, William was actually a German. He had been raised in the Principality of Nassau in Germany. But he had great holdings in the Netherlands. He was one of the great noblemen of the Netherlands. He loved the Dutch people. And he was one of the most remarkable leaders anywhere in Europe in the 16th century. He was a man of great compassion and great tolerance in a rather intolerant age. He also possessed a very strong religious commitment. He was devoted to the church. Although he didn't always follow his Calvinist advisors, at least not the most orthodox Calvinist clergy advisors, in every detail. William believed that in order to succeed against this tyrant Philip and retain the autonomy of the provinces and retain freedom of worship instead of being ruled by bishops imposed by Philip, the only way it could be done would be by having the Roman Catholics and the Protestants work together against Philip. Now, that was quite a challenge. Some of the nobility were Protestants, some were Roman Catholic, but not all wanted to work together. But William was instrumental in promoting this attitude. And yet, William also realized that an attitude of cooperation wasn't even enough. They actually need another country, another world power to help them, because Spain was, after all, the number one world power of the day. And so he looked around. He looked first to Germany. No help there. The Lutherans did not want to help Protestants and Roman Catholics in their coalition. They said, "We'll help you only if the Protestants and the Roman Catholics become Lutherans." Well, if you know Dutch people, that doesn't work either. So William looked to France. He looked to a man, a powerful, strong military leader named Gaspar Coligny. And Gaspar agreed to come and help him. But sadly, tragically, in 1572, before he had a chance to do so, in the great St. Bartholomew's Massacre, which 20,000 French Protestant leaders were killed, Gaspar himself was killed and could not come to his aid. And so then William looked to England, to Queen Elizabeth. Well, the Queen gave Philip, or gave William rather, lots of encouragement. Words of encouragement. She sent him a few troops. But the Queen thought, little Netherlands will never last against world power Spain. And I don't want to be on the losing side, because as soon as Philip wipes out the Netherlands, He's coming to England next. And Elizabeth knew how to protect herself. So behind the scenes, she was encouraging the Dutch. And in one way, she wanted the Dutch-Spanish war to continue. Because she thought, as long as Philip is busy with the Dutch, he won't come after the English. He's only got so many forces. So she kind of played cat and mouse in the whole situation, which was a disappointment to William as well. And so, really, no one came to the aid of William. And everyone believed, even the Dutch people believed, that it was just a matter of time before the Spaniards would take over. And yet the Dutch people said, "We will fight to the end." And so William battled on. And the fortunes of war waxed and waned for a decade or two. And there were many remarkable stories of what happened in these days. Great, heroic Dutch tales that real Dutch people in the Netherlands still enjoy reveling in and telling their children today. Probably the most famous is the siege on Leiden, the great Dutch city of Leiden. You know, most of the battles revolved around the great cities of the Netherlands. Because Philip knew if he got the cities, he'd have the land. And so the Spaniards had surrounded Leiden. They were actually starving the people. And Philip would send in, William would send in notices to Leiden encouraging the Leidenites not to give up, to persevere, and to wait on the Lord for victory. But where was victory to come from? It was only a matter of time before they would starve to death. Well, the difficulty was impossible. Finally, William and his advisors think up a wild, unimaginable plan. They would break the dikes the Dutch had built. Remember, much of the Netherlands was below sea level and had been reclaimed from the sea and was protected by great dikes that kept out of the sea, kept out the sea already in those days. And so what they did is they smashed the dikes around London, Leiden. And then they waited for several days before the wind blew in the right direction. And when the wind changed and came in across the lowlands, the Spanish army woke up one morning to find itself ankle deep and then knee deep in water as the sea began to rise around the city of London. And then they looked up and saw the Dutch navy in their flat-bottomed boats beginning to sail in to confront the Spanish army. And the Spanish army was not equipped to fight sea battles like this. And they were astonished, taken aback, and they fled from the Dutch. So the siege was lifted and the Spanish withdrew. Now, the war was by no means over. This just went on and on and on. In 1579, William drew up what was called the Union of Utrecht, one of the great cities. And he brought representatives from the 17 different provinces to Utrecht to sign this document. But to his surprise, only the northern provinces would sign. And the southern ones refused. Because the southern provinces were tired of the war. And they wanted it to end. The northern provinces were very concerned that many of the southern provinces were too amenable to Roman Catholicism. And so they wanted the war to continue to make sure that all the provinces would become reformed and Protestant. So, unwittingly, William himself, William of Orange, who's such a great hero in the Dutch mind, was actually instrumental in sealing the division between the northern Netherlands and the southern Netherlands. And that's why the Netherlands today is so much smaller than it was at that time. Now, the northern provinces then asked William to run the provinces together. He was such a hero, they wanted him to be the leader. They didn't really want a republic. But William said, I did not fight this war to become your president or your monarch, and I don't want to go down in history as a man who led resistance to Philip for his own selfish reasons. So he refused. Then the northern provinces asked Queen Elizabeth to be their ruler, over against Philip, of course. And she refused. She thought, Philip will surely come after me then. And so, the United Provinces of the Netherlands became known as the United Provinces of the Netherlands, and by default, a republic was formed. Now, William fought till the end, until he was cruelly assassinated in 1584. That, too, made him a great hero in the Dutch people's eyes, because what happened in 1584 is that Philip II issued a bounty on his head, a huge sum of money, if someone would assassinate William. And William refused to have bodyguards, so he just lived in his normal way in the city of Delft. And a Spaniard traveled to the Netherlands to kill him and found him on the street. And the Spaniard actually was very poor, didn't have a weapon to kill him with, and asked William, he said, I'm a beggar, I came from Spain, will you give me some money so I can eat? And William said yes, and he gave him some money so he could eat. Well, the guy went and bought some pistols and came back and shot him. And he was really a martyr for the cause. In fact, if you go to Delft today, you can still see the bullet holes in the walls where they passed through William's body. Now, after William's death, there was two people that came to the foreground. Johan van Oldenbarnevelt and Prince Maurice. Two men, both very gifted, and both very much in tension with each other. Van Oldenbarnevelt was an administrative figure, a diplomatic figure, kind of aristocratic, talented man who could negotiate things, organize things. So he emerges as the prime executive of the Netherlands. Then there's another man named Maurice, who's William of Orange's son. And because he's his son, and because he's a very effective general like his father, and a commander of the Dutch forces taking over from his father, he becomes very popular. Now, Van Oldenbarnevelt, you see, he wants to get rid of the war. And he doesn't care anymore if the southern provinces go Roman Catholic. Prince Maurice, being conservative, being reformed, being religious, cares very much and says the war must continue until we win all the southern provinces back. And so that's the tension. That's the political situation, the setting in which Calvinism comes to the Netherlands. So let's spend the rest of our time now looking then at the religious history of the Netherlands. So in the 1540s and 1550s, the Dutch people are fond of speaking of this phrase, the churches under the cross. And what they mean by that is that Reformed people who came to the Netherlands, as well as Anabaptists, were persecuted in these days. Often they worshipped in secret, and their activities were in secret. And the problem today, as a historian, is that there's very few records that survive about exactly what they did and when they did it. There are some things we know. I'll just mention two quick things to you. The first is this, that there was within the Reformed community itself two major views on how to respond to the persecution. One view was Calvin's view, and Calvin wrote to the Dutch to act in this way, and that is to come right out in the open, to not hide your faith. And even if it means your life, well, if it means your life, you just go to be with Jesus sooner. So be bold and go out and stand up for the truth, no matter what happens. The other group among the churches under the cross said, no, that's foolish. We've got to be wise here. We've got to meet in secret. Keep our religious beliefs private. and seek to spread through some kind of underground way the Reformed faith. Now, Calvin actually wrote an apology later because his book created such a stir. Calvin was very well respected. And he said, I really haven't fundamentally changed my position. I believe principally a Christian should always be open and speak out in the midst of society. But my book was too harsh and it was too rigorous. And so I take back the attitude with which I wrote it. I didn't mean to look down upon those who are carrying on their religion in a secretive way. So you see, there was this double view. Now, the second thing we need to say about these years is that despite all this persecution that went on, first persecuting the Anabaptists, then persecuting the Reformed who came under Calvin's influence, despite this, the Dutch churches began to organize themselves in an underground way. They had secret meetings. They organized themselves into various church classes and synods and so on, and actually began to multiply and enlarge themselves, particularly in the province of Flanders and Brabant. The Reform movement in those southern provinces grew to be very substantial. Now, there's a great debate. There's a great debate in Dutch circles, even till today among the scholars, about exactly how influential the conservative Reform movement was in the 40s and 50s. It wasn't the masses of people. But of the Reform people, the majority of them were very conservative and wanted to implement the kind of thing, the kind of doctrine, the kind of church structure that Calvin was proposing. And so the persecuted churches began to speak out, also in written form. And the first great famous document they wrote was primarily penned by a man named Guido de Bray. And de Bray wanted to write to Philip II an explanation of exactly what the Reformed believed, because he had this idea that if you explain to the Reform to Philip exactly what we believe, we're not threatening, we're not Anabaptists, we're not going AWOL on society. We really will be citizens, we'll fight in a just war, we'll take vows before judges. We're not radicals. You're mixing us up, Philip. And Philip was. The Reformed with the Anabaptists. And so what Guido de Bray did was he wrote 36 articles that really explained the whole of the Christian faith. And then he wrote a letter to the king, to Philip, and explained to Philip, you don't need to be threatened by us. We just want to be law-abiding citizens living in peace in the Netherlands. Just let us be. We won't do you any harm. And then the letter and the document, which we now call the Belgic Confession of Faith, was thrown over the wall in the king's palace. And apparently the king read it, but had no favorable response to it. Now, the Belgic Confession, which was built largely off of the Gallic Confession, a 1559 French Reformed Confession that actually Calvin influenced greatly, soon became a very staple document. And the persecuted Dutch Reformed churches rallied around the Belgic Confession. And it became a standard by which they adhered. And the early convents, the Convent of Wesel, and then the early synods, the Synod of Emden, and so on, they all embraced the Belgic Confession as representative of what they believed. Now, what happens then is Guido de Bray gets persecuted and Philip demands his death. And he flees, we don't know exactly, but somewhere between 10 and 20 different places in a 6-year period. And finally, someone betrays him and they catch him. and he dies. He's a martyr. They spill his blood. And so the very first Dutch Reform standard of the three forms of unity cost the blood of the author, the primary author. Apparently De Bray had some other people help him write it to some degree. But the Dutch people, the real Dutch Reformed people in the Netherlands today, really deeply admired De Bray for doing what he did at the risk of his life and for being a martyr. And so when they read this confession, they read it through the eyes of this history, that this martyr has given his life to give us this truth today. Now, the beauty of the Belgic Confession is that it is written in the standard Reformed systematic theology order. Perhaps you know that order. There's really six major areas of doctrine. There's the doctrine of God, called theology proper, the doctrine of man, called anthropology, the doctrine of Christ, Christology, the doctrine of salvation, soteriology, the doctrine of the church, ecclesiology, and the doctrine of the last things, called eschatology. Well, that's still the standard used today, and De Bray actually follows that order in the Belgic Confession. But what is so beautiful is he does it with great warmth and passion and great scripturalness, with lots of scriptural support. It's a very scriptural document, well worthy of your reading today. And so this becomes a very important development in the Dutch Reformed history. Now, about that same time, actually a year later, something else very important happens in Dutch history, and that is in the neighboring Palatinate, which is in the northern part of Germany, but very close to where the Netherlands was, there is a growing reform movement that is affiliated with the Netherlands. And there comes an elector in that area by the name of Frederick III, nicknamed Frederick the Pious, a very godly man, who grew up as a pauper, and very unusual in those days, ascended to the electorate, to be one of the electors under Philip. And this man has a great battle on his hands, because on the one side there's a lot of Lutherans in the area, and the other side there's a lot of Reformed people coming into the area. And in those days, of course, the two could not live together. So Frederick writes Peter Martyr, the great reformer, he was as influential in that day as John Calvin was, and sadly is hardly known today, although he is in the Reformation Heroes book. Peter Martyr advises him, I'm too old to come and help you, but what you need to do is you need to have someone write a catechism for your Palatinate area. And I've got a young man here that can help you. He's already written a minor catechism and a larger catechism. His name is Zacharias Ursinus. He's only 28 years old. He's an amazingly gifted theologian. He studied under Philip Melanchthon, the right-hand man of Martin Luther, so he understands Lutheranism, but he's really a Calvinist, and he can help move and solidify the Palatinate to become thoroughly reformed, but he can do it in an Irenic, peaceful way. So Frederick gets quite excited, and he writes to Ursinus, and Ursinus says, sure, I'll come. But Frederick thinks that we need more than one person to write this. It's got to have some authority, some backing. Ursinus is a theologian. We need a pastoral emphasis on it. So he hears about a guy by the name of Caspar Olivianus, who's only 26 years old, but who's such a powerful preacher that when he came to the city of Treves, within a matter of weeks, the church was filled and people were sitting on the windowsills and outside of the churches. And the authorities were so upset that his preaching was so popular that they warned him, if you keep preaching next Sunday and the following Sunday, we will arrest you. And he went right on and preached, and he was now thrown in jail. And he's a great pastor, great preacher. And Frederick thought, you know what? I want to get this man here. I want to get him out of jail and get him here. And he'll help Ursinus write this catechism. So he writes the officials in Treves. And they say, well, if you pay us so much money, we'll let him out of jail. And he's got to promise never to set foot in this city again in his entire life. That's what happened. And so Olivianus, the preacher, and Ursinus, the professor, come together. Very different personalities. and they write the catechism. Probably Ursinus wrote about 80% of it. But Olivianus had a pastoral note throughout it all. And it was such a powerful document. So warmly written, so ironic, so pastoral, yet so thoroughly reformed. That when it was completed, Frederick, who also supervised it and had a hand in it, watched it, read it constantly, made comments together with some of the professors in the College of the Holy Spirit there. Frederick called different Reformed leaders from around other countries and brought them together, and they had an official reading of it, January 19, 1563, on a Saturday. And you know what happened? Very much unlike the Westminster Assembly documents, which were debated for years, you know. When this document was read in their hearing, to a man, all the reformers from different communities stood up and said, "We embrace the Heidelberg Catechism fully." And they didn't change a word. Only later on, Frederick, and coming from Calvin probably, wanted to add one more question about the Roman Catholic Mass, question 80. Otherwise, no changes were made. And they unitedly, unanimously accepted the Heidelberg Catechism as authoritative for what the Reformed churches believed as a doctrinal standard to hold up not only in Germany, but throughout Europe. And they were so happy with it that they decided to stay the weekend and not go home and celebrate the Lord's Supper together the next day. That's what they did. Within 3 years, this catechism was translated into every single European language. And shortly thereafter, many Asian and African languages as well. Today, it's available in over 400 languages. And it became the most popular Reformed document ever written. Within 2 years, Dutch preachers were preaching from it as topically for their afternoon sermon. It began to meet twice on Sunday. Travel was a big deal in those days. It was hard to get to church twice. But no matter how few people would come to the afternoon service, they began to preach through it topically so that their people could understand. So they divided it into 52 sections, one for every Lord's Day. And that became a very strong part of the Dutch Reformation. And that is one of the major reasons why the Dutch people, till today, tend to know their doctrine very, very well. Some people say tend to be very stubborn about their doctrine. But actually, it's not so much stubbornness as it is that they're well-grounded. I mean, they know the three offices of Christ. They know the two human natures of Christ. They know the five steps of humiliation. They know the four steps of exaltation. They know the doctrines of grace. They know their Christology, their anthropology. They know because they hear it preached every year. Every major doctrine is preached to them once a year. Now, catechism was very biblical. Hence, it was penetrated with 700 proof texts to show that really all it is a summary of what the Bible says on every particular topic. And so these 129 questions of the Heidelberg Catechism became very, very important in the Dutch Reformation. In fact, it became more popular in the Netherlands than any other country on the globe. And every synod, particularly the famous National Synod of Dort, 1619, would ratify that the Heidelberg Catechism is the second, next to the Belgic Confession, of the three forms of unity that the Reformed churches of the Netherlands would embrace. Now, meanwhile, you see, the Dutch, through these various meetings, are working on church-state relationships. And they're trying more and more to become Calvinistic. But it's a challenge. Because in the Netherlands as well, there are two different views. One view is called the Erastian view. The other is called the Calvinistic view. I don't know if you've ever heard of Thomas Erastus, but he was a Lutheran theologian. And he agreed with Luther, and with Zwingli, by the way, that the ultimate authority in a society should be the state. And so the discipline of individuals in a church should actually be a state decision, since the church is under the state. Calvin, of course, said church and state have their own spheres. And the state may not interfere with the church and with its discipline of its members, because this is a spiritual matter for the church. And of course, Calvin is right. But in those days, this was a heady battle between the two. And since Erastians dominated the states general, that is, there were at least four of the seven that were Erastian in their church-state view, that meant that the synods could not meet openly, but they had to meet secretly. So they would often go across the border and meet in some Belgian city and have their meeting, 1568, 1571, 1574, 1578, 1581, 1586. Six of them. And they established all kinds of church orderliness, church offices. They established ministry, elders and deacons. They established the whole system of consistories, the Dutch call it, with a classis, a meeting of several churches, and then a particular synod, and then a synod. All this was organized underground because the Erastians were in power. And they had to be united, you see, to call a national synod, and the Erastians refused to call a national synod. Now along comes James Arminius. And James Arminius is used in God's providence to bring all these things to a head. And who is he? Well, this is our last major thought: Arminius and the Synod of Dort. Arminius, ironically, becomes the most famous reformer of the Dutch churches, if you can call him that. You see, almost every other country had one man who was at the helm. You know, Germany had its Luther, right? Scotland had its Knox. But who does the Dutch have? Well, they have some famous political leaders. Petrus Dathenus, perhaps? Perhaps he'd be the most famous. But how many of you have heard of Petrus Dathenus? Probably not many of you, unless you're in the Dutch tradition. Petrus Dathenus did some wonderful things, and he organized the church liturgy of the Dutch Reformed churches, borrowing from all kinds of liturgies, and he was a great preacher. But in the end of his life, he kind of backslid, and he's not really altogether admirable in every way, and never really became the kind of hero that Knox became. And so through Arminius's errors and his departures from the Reformed faith and all the trouble he caused to the Reform, even while he claimed himself to still be Reformed, when you think of the Netherlands today and you think of names in the Reformation, James Arminius is the first probably that comes to mind. Now Arminius was educated well. He was a gracious fellow. He was politically on the side of the Erastians. He married into a very noble family. He was kind of aristocratic. He had good PR skills. He knew how to relate to people. He had a powerful personality. He got people around him. He was kind of peace-loving. He didn't make waves if he didn't have to. He did a lot of things secretly, underhandedly. And there's a lot we don't know about Arminius till today, about it, what he exactly believed in those early years. We do know that when he went to Geneva and studied under Calvin's successor, Beza, that there was some trouble between Beza and the faculty in Arminius. But we also know that whatever that trouble was, it got ironed out, and eventually Beza actually gave him a letter of commendation back to the Netherlands to become a pastor in the Netherlands, which is where he went, and he became a pastor in the Dutch Reformed Church of Amsterdam for 15 years. He was there about 3 years. He's preaching through Romans. And he gets to Romans 7. He does something radical, unheard of in those days. He says that the struggles of Paul in Romans 7. Remember the struggles? The good that I would, I find myself not doing. The evil that I would not, I do. Oh, wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? I find a law in my members, and another law striving against this law, this holy tug of war, which the Reformers always said goes on in the believer between the new man and the old nature. One end pulling on the like a rope, pulling, tugging. The other end pulling the other way, and the struggle that goes on in the soul of the believer between the lust of the flesh and the new nature. No, 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 says Arminius in his sermons. This is Paul speaking about who he was before he was regenerated. And Romans 8, about the victory of the Christian life and so on. That's who Paul really is. That's the new creature. That's Paul after he's regenerated. Well, this creates a ruckus. I mean, the Dutch know their theology. And this troubles the Dutch greatly. And for 2 or 3 years, it shakes up the whole community, and it runs throughout all the Netherlands. And Arminius plays low-key in all of this, and eventually the whole thing just kind of disappears from the horizon, and people get tired of talking about it. And he gets away with it. Now today, to show you Arminius' influence, today there are actually Reformed theologians in most seminaries, most Reformed seminaries, who take Arminius' position, and nobody says boo or bah. Well, things calm down. Arminius goes on and preaches. He's preaching through Romans very slowly. About 3 years later, he gets to Romans 9. Predestination. Oh, boy. Is he getting into trouble here? Basically, what he says is this. God predestinates people, but he sees ahead of time who's going to believe. And he gives some credibility to the human will as instrumental in the soul's salvation, and says, God predestinates, foreordains those who will believe. Well, this too, of course, was very much opposed to Beza's teaching and Perkins' teaching and so on. And this too creates a whole bunch of ruckus. And it even comes to the States General, and they decide that they won't touch it, and they try to calm things down because they, most of them tended to be a bit Arminian at that time themselves. And so the whole thing, again, passes by eventually. Now in 1608, Arminius reads a document called the Declaration of Sentiments to the government, in which he finally, openly sets forth his views. And he explains that he sees a role for man's will in the process of man's salvation and so on. So salvation is by grace. He gives a large place to grace. But it's not without the will of man. So the will of man, much like Melanchthon would later say, or had said, is also part of salvation. Now, Arminius goes on to say in this document that therefore, because the will has to be inclined, grace can do it, but it's dependent on my will. Therefore, salvation can always be resisted. So I don't believe, said Arminius, in irresistible grace. Now, this brings Arminius in a great deal of trouble, and he's attacked on all sides. And the government is trying to protect him. And suddenly, in the midst of it all, he dies. And the government sighs with relief and says, oh, I hope this problem goes away. But he had influenced enough people, it didn't go away. And in 1610, people who are now being called Arminians, followers of Arminius, write what they call a remonstrance, that is, an objection to the States General. It's called the Remonstrance Document. And in that document, they basically say 5 things. They basically say man is not totally depraved. His will can have some generic ability to be helpful in his own salvation. They say that predestination is based on foreseen faith. They say that Jesus Christ died for everyone, not just for his people. Grace is resistible. And they say, we're not sure whether the saints persevere or not, but we think that there's no guarantee of their perseverance. We think they can fall away. We're not 100% sure. So they raise 5 points of objection to the traditional Reformed faith, and they ask the States General, is it possible that you can make a decree politically that we who embrace these 5 deviations from the Reformed faith can serve in positions of leadership in churches, as ministers, as professors, without being considered heretical. That's what they're asking. And so, well, the States General take this up, they talk about it, and Ben Olden Barneveld, being the political guy he is, decides he wants to try. He knows this could bring the whole of the Netherlands to a civil war, so he wants to try to downplay it. He postpones it, he drags his feet, he kind of minimizes it. He tries to avoid it. He tries to keep it secret. Well, just like today, when you try to keep things secret in politics, it never works. And before you know it, it explodes throughout the country. And the Netherlands is on the verge of civil war. That these Arminians are being tolerated. The majority, you see, of the common people are still Calvinistic. And they won't tolerate this. This is a very different day, remember, in Europe than we have today, which we are pluralistic and we tolerate all kinds of churches around us. No, the church in the Netherlands was a state church. The Reformed church was a state church. If you didn't like it, you see, you're supposed to leave the country and go somewhere else. And so people are very upset about this. Within the Reformed church, people who are challenging the doctrines of sovereign grace are being allowed to continue in position. So they too clamor for a national synod. And finally, by a vote of 4-3, the States General in 1617 call for a national synod. And they come together in the National Synod of Dort. And what happens there at the National Synod is probably well known to you. The first few months, they're debating with the Arminians, and of course, Arminius is dead. The leader is Simon Episcopius, and he speaks endlessly. He tries to drag things out when he sees that the majority of delegates who've come from all kinds of countries, it's the first international synod of the Reformed faith ever held, are all against him. But finally, he drags things out so interminably long that the chairman, Johannes Bogerman, finally one day loses his temper and says, "You Arminians, be gone. And we will deal with your remonstrance." And he sends them all away. Well, it wasn't politically correct. But then the Reform got to work. And in a couple months, they churned out this amazing document we call the Canons of Dort, in which they positively state the Reform doctrine in these five areas, and then have a whole section behind each chapter of errors corrected, in which they deal with every little nuance of the Arminian errors. And what they end up doing, you see then, is they have 34 articles in all and 59 errors corrected. Now, in the 1900s, Lorraine Bettner comes along, about 1920, and takes these 5 points and rearranges them in order and develops this thing called TULIP as an acronym. Total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, perseverance of the saints. That is not what Dort did. That's a fairly accurate representation of Dort. Nor does Dort claim that these 5 points of Calvinism, as they came to be called, is all of what Calvinism is all about. In fact, the very point of my book, Living for the Glory of God, is that there's 20-some areas in which we need to talk about Calvinism, not just five. It is a summary, a good summary, of the basics of the doctrine of salvation, how a sinner gets saved. But it's not all of Calvinism by any means. Calvinism is much broader, much more comprehensive than that. And so what happens by May of 1619? The Synod of Dort writes the Canons of Dort, ratifies them, and these become accepted by the Senate, together with the Belgic Confession, the Heidelberg Catechism, as the three forms of unity. So just as you Presbyterians would have the Westminster Standards, Confession of Faith, Shorter Catechism, Larger Catechism, three documents, so the Dutch have three documents. The Belgic Confession, which surveys the whole field of doctrine in an orderly way. The Heidelberg Catechism, which surveys the whole field of doctrine, but in an experiential order, how we experience things in terms of knowing our sin and misery, then being delivered in Christ, and then living a life of gratitude, very warm, experiential way. And the Canons of Dort is a summary of the doctrine of salvation from a polemical direction, defending that doctrine against error. Now, in conclusion, the Synod of Dort did several other things that most people don't know about. They also established the need for a Bible translation, the Statenvertaling, which became as famous as the King James Version today in English. They also discussed the question, how do you get young people to really love the Heidelberg Catechism? And they said, well, they should memorize it. And if they don't memorize it, they shouldn't be allowed to get married, because they should know the catechism before they get married, because their marriage depends on scriptural truth. Well, that wasn't followed completely, but that was the idea, you see. That's how important the catechism was to them. You couldn't get married unless you had it memorized. Thirdly, they discussed the Sunday afternoon service. A lot of people had a hard time coming to church both times. What should we do? Should we give it up? No, they said. Only the pastor alone comes with his own family, and they're the only ones in church, he should preach a catechism sermon to his own family. It's that important. You don't ever give it up. Always come to church twice, they said. Then they said, what about Sunday? They debated the whole question of the Sabbath. They decide that, yes, the continuation of the fourth commandment is valid. It's a day of worship. People should cease from ordinary activity, from all money-making activities. Recreation, they left a little opening, maybe for a little, but it should never interfere with public worship. But they said, this is only provisional advice. We haven't studied this thoroughly, but this is our advice at the present time. Then they discussed the question of whether servants from the mission field should be baptized if they're under their care. And they adopted a thorough Reformed church order, which, by the way, still operates in many Reformed churches today. And so that leads me to this conclusion, that the Dutch Reformation offers us an example of a remarkable combination of political and religious factors, of great heroism, of great doctrinal standard writing, of great difficulties and trials and controversies, perhaps some mistakes. But through it all, God forged a people who loved the doctrines of grace and who became stalwart sons and daughters of the Reformation. And I ask you tonight, are you a stalwart son and daughter of the Reformation? Do you love Reformed truth? Would you be willing to suffer and die for it? Is it in your lifeblood? Does your salvation depend upon it? Do you treasure it? Are you truly a son or a daughter of the Reformation? God bless you.